This evening I'd like to speak about compassion. The Buddha was once asked by a student, that would it be true to say that a part of our practice is for the development of love and compassion? And the Buddha answered, no, it wouldn't be true to say that. That it would be true to say that the whole of our practice is dedicated to love and compassion. If you explore the body of very ancient Buddhist stories that are so central to this tradition, what you discover again and again is this call to discover the compassion that is possible for each one of us. What you see or find are stories of great courage, of boundless generosity, of unconditional love, that are often told through the stories of those who are called bodhisattvas, or those who dedicate themselves deeply to the end of all suffering. And these stories speak about the ways in which, through time, in countless different ways and places, there is this kind of enduring spirit, which is dedicated to relieving suffering without conditions. What these stories do is that they invite, I think, each one of us to reflect really on how boundless, how encompassing our own hearts can be. They invite each one of us to discover what depths of wisdom, of balance, of patience, of forgiveness that we're able to find within our own minds and hearts. Now, these stories, of course, are found not only in the Buddhist tradition, but every great tradition holds within it the stories of the bodhisattvas, who essentially teach by example, who embody in how they live, in how they relate to others, the power of compassion. Now, all of these stories, of course, they do have a purpose, and their purpose is not to encourage us to somehow look to the past and somehow only admire or envy these seemingly enlightened, wonderful people. But the purpose of these stories is to invite us to explore our own story and to encourage us to see that both the capacity to create suffering and the capacity to cause suffering really live side by side within us. That both of those capacities are part, almost we might say, of the human heritage, of the human story. But these stories also invite us to understand that we have a very special, a very precious capacity within us. That we have the capacity for awareness, for honesty, for reflection, for inquiry. And that these capacities that we hold within us actually give us a tremendous amount of freedom. Because they give us freedom to follow and to cultivate pathways in our lives that we know are ones of both wisdom and compassion. It is those very precious qualities that really enable us to see that in our own lives, in our own hearts, we are actually not just driven by instinct or by blind reaction. But perhaps we also see that this capacity for awareness and the capacity for self-awareness, that sometimes it seems like a blessing and sometimes it seems like a curse. That this capacity for awareness, what it does is that it actually illuminates or lights up the forces and the powers within our own hearts and mind that move us in our life, in our speech, in our actions, and in our choices. And mirrored in awareness, of course, is everything that makes us a human being. And what we see mirrored in awareness are sometimes the fears, the angers, the greed, the self-protectiveness that we can struggle with. And yet also mirrored in awareness, sometimes to our surprise, are the qualities of forgiveness, of compassion, of kindness, of sensitivity. I think each one of us are ultimately asked to make this journey in our lives of exploring really how it is that we want to live. Invited to make this journey of exploring what it is that we are actually dedicated to in our lives. We are asked to understand really what brings about the end of suffering, not just for ourselves, but what directly contributes to the end of sorrow in every living being. Milarepa, who is one of the great Tibetan yogis, once said that after long years of contemplating compassion, I came to understand that there is no difference between self and other. In this journey of exploring what brings about the end of suffering, we're not actually asked to go out and do some kind of heroic deed. We're not asked to go down and lay down our lives or even to change the world. What we are clearly asked to explore is how we can transform our world of this moment. What we're clearly asked to explore is how we hold this moment, how we receive ourselves. We're asked to explore what kind of thoughts, what kind of feelings run through us that lead to the words and to the actions and to the choices that we make. We're asked to explore the feelings and thoughts that lead us to relate in one way or another to the person in front of us or to ourselves. We are asked to understand that we are not helpless. We are not entirely a victim of our past or our history or our fears, simply because we can see. We can make choices. We can discriminate and understand what path we do follow in our lives, and we can explore what really does give meaning and depth to the fabric of our lives. And this is actually something that is quite heroic. You know, I always feel that it really does take immense courage to turn towards suffering and conflict rather than to turn away from it. That it takes just an incredible steadiness and dedication to be willing to turn towards those in our world who struggle, to turn even towards the very sometimes dark rooms of our own hearts and minds where fear or greed or anger or resentment can live. It takes an immense courage to open our hearts to the reality of the countless people in our world who really suffer a daily diet of violence, of oppression, of terror, of alienation. There are a lot of other things we could be doing. There are a lot of other things, a lot of other ways we could respond rather than turning towards all of this. We could make other choices of avoidance, of fantasy, of pretending that it doesn't exist, of self-gratification, of denial. And yet even those responses don't ask for blame, but for compassion. Because even those responses, that they too are part of the tapestry of pain and sorrow. Recently, I came across this really remarkable book called Whispered Prayers. And it's a book in which, through pictures and through very, very short stories, the lives of there's about 30 Tibetan people who speak about their lives, who tell their own stories. And within this book, there's a whole mixture of people, of young people, of old people, of children, of monks and nuns, their grandparents, who speak really in just so few words about some of the really inhuman atrocities they have gone through in their lives, of imprisonment, of torture, of imposed sterilization, of the loss of family and home. And when I read those stories, there were a number of things that really so stood out from them. One of them, of course, was the depth of the pain, the sorrow. The other was that none of these people actually looked like particularly exceptional people, whatever an exceptional person looks like. And yet all of them had been through these journeys of almost unending pain and loss to themselves and their family. But something else that really stood out was the way in which their hearts were so intact that they wept, they grieved, they felt immense sorrow. But they didn't see their dignity or their fortitude, or their compassion as being anything exceptional, but that they saw their fortitude and their compassion really as a very simple path, almost as if there was no other choice. And I want to read you just one of those stories. It's told by a young nun who tells of being arrested and imprisoned for putting up a Free Tibet poster. She said, "During the interrogation that took place twice a week, I was beaten and tortured. To stay alive, I meditated on peace and nonviolence every possible moment I could. I tried my hardest to pray for peace for all humankind. Again and again, I meditated in my prison and in my prayers. I did not feel particularly sad or angry. If the police noticed my lips moving, they told me to stop or I would be punished further. So I whispered my prayers secretly, barely moving my lips at all. A group of us celebrated the Dalai Lama's birthday in prison by singing traditional Tibetan songs. As punishment, they put me in an ice house and removed my clothing for 3 long days. Then the beatings resumed and they went on for weeks. My prayers for peace and nonviolence also went on and on with even greater intensity." In all of the stories told in this book. What was truly stunning for me was really the remarkable absence of blame, of anger, of rage, or of the desire for retaliation. There was the understanding of ignorance, that the jailers lived in the prison of their own ignorance. Now we may or may not find ourselves ever in such a situation of deprivation or fear, but we will all find ourselves in situations in many, many moments in our lives where we are faced with the choice of either following the pathway of anger, of greed, of hatred, or in fear, or of following the pathway of generosity, of compassion, of understanding. I think it is very important to understand that compassion is not a future destination. It is not an ideal to hold in our mind as something that we will reach much later on in our lives. Compassion is about the present, about who we are and how we are in this moment, and what we cultivate and what kind of path we follow. Sometimes it is said, if you want to know about your past, look at your mind now. It's also said, if you want to know your future, look at your mind now. Cultivating compassion really is a practice of caring for this heart and mind, for caring with mindfulness, with awareness. Compassion doesn't arise because we decide we want to be compassionate. It's not something so mechanical that we can manufacture. But it is cultivated inwardly, based on mindfulness, based on genuine understanding. And actually, this is really a very personal matter. No one can find that for us. No one can investigate our own inner world with us. No one can convince us, other than ourselves, of the genuine worth of empathy and compassion. But we investigate this for ourselves through attending so closely, so carefully, to the rhythms of our own heart and mind, acknowledging that our hearts and minds, they are the forerunner of how we engage with the world, with other people, and with the events that we encounter. Compassion is also not just a feeling. It's not just a state of mind or heart. It's a way of engaging with life. It's about how we actually engage with the world around us, with the world of people, of events. It's learning how to interact with responsiveness and understanding to relieve suffering. In this investigation, this exploration of the rhythms of our own heart and mind, we come to understand that there is no word, there is no action, there is no thought, there is no choice that is unimportant or irrelevant. Because every thought, every feeling, every way that we respond makes an impact upon the world around us and upon ourselves. And finally, in this exploration of the rhythms of our own heart and mind, we come to understand that to care for others is to care for ourselves. And that to care for ourselves is to care for others. And that basically we learn to live in a way that leaves few remainders in our hearts and minds. I think sometimes when we first come to meditation or first look at meditation, it looks like a very self-absorbed affair. You know, perhaps it looks like a very self-centered affair. You know, we sit here together or we look at people sitting, and it seems as if the whole direction of meditation is somehow to focus only on our inner world, to understand our own demons and shadows, or to find in our meditation, you know, a greater sense of personal happiness or personal well-being or personal peace. And to some extent, it's true. Meditation is, in that sense, a very personal affair. But what is it that we meet in this inner world? What is it really that we meet when we explore our own hearts and minds? We meet all hearts and minds. What we really come to understand when we explore this heart and mind is we start to see what causes suffering and the ways to end suffering. We see the ways, all of us, that we can get lost in indifference, in anger, in judgment, in alienation. And what we see clearly, that the result is always pain. The result is always suffering. I mean, you've probably had experiences here, you know, where you've sat for 45 minutes absolutely lost in some kind of storm of obsession or self-judgment or aversion or negativity. And you know, what happens when you come out of that? You know, do you come out of that saying, oh, you know, I feel a lot better, you know, I was really great, you know, I feel so much happier now? We don't. We come out of it, we feel exhausted, we feel undermined, we feel pain. We feel tighter. We begin to see in ourselves what doesn't work. This is really important. To understand what doesn't work in our own experience. What doesn't lead to happiness. What doesn't lead to freedom. We perhaps see that we could sit there for an hour shouting at ourselves and blaming at ourselves and trying to fix things and trying to resolve everything. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't lead anywhere. The amazing thing in our lives, I think, sometimes is that we give so much energy to things that produce so few positive results, you know, in terms of judgment and obsession. But we also begin to understand what ends suffering. This also we have to see in our own experience. What is it that ends suffering? It's not that hard. We begin to appreciate the blessing and the power of forgiveness, of compassion, of acceptance, of generosity of heart, of insight. And we learn these lessons in ourselves. And in this inner world we are exploring, we are meeting all worlds. We are meeting all minds and hearts. You know, sometimes we believe that our mind is somehow, and our heart is somehow special and different and unique, much more shameful than anybody else's. You know, if I was to ask here for a volunteer who would be willing, if this was at all possible, to have their mind broadcast over a loudspeaker for 45 minutes, I mean, who would volunteer? But mostly, if we did that, you know, we would feel afraid to do that. We would feel ashamed to do that because we feel, oh no, you know, this is so terrible what happens in me, my obsessions, my judgments. But mostly what would happen if that was possible is that you would have a room of people sitting there saying, I know this. I know this. I know this mind. I know these feelings. And yet, we see, even knowing that on one level, we understand that it's not necessarily possible for us to fix everything. You know, we don't have an answer for everything. We can't necessarily solve the dilemmas or the struggles or the storms of someone else, and they can't always ease ours. Yet, we learn some very powerful lessons. about how to heal ourselves, how to let go, how to listen, how not to be a cause of suffering in the moment. And we come to trust in those lessons. The Buddha once said, the thought becomes the word. The word becomes the deed. The deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its way with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. I think as we sit with ourselves and listen to ourselves, we really can't help but appreciate the power that our thoughts and our emotions have, the way that they impact our bodies, the way that they shape our words, our responses, our actions. We also appreciate just the energetic power of our thoughts and emotions to shape the very form of our bodies and minds on a moment-to-moment level. When we listen to ourselves, we begin to see more and more clearly that the causes of sorrow and the causes of joy really find their beginning in our own heart and mind. And we begin with compassion to truly care for the way of our thoughts, the way of our feelings. We care for where they come from and where they go. We discern what does lead to suffering and what does lead to healing and to love. And we listen to our thoughts and feelings. And we see what a huge range there is. Sometimes what we're listening to is anger, is fear, is blame, is judgment. Sometimes we hear the tones of love, of patience, of generosity. Some of them are repetitive. Some of these thoughts we make very frequent visits to, and some of them we see clearly are painful and that they lead to pain. Sometimes when we do see that, we're very tempted to blame. We say, it's your fault, it's my fault. Blame seems to be a way out of the helplessness we often feel when we are faced with pain, when we've been hurt by others, or when we've even inflicted pain upon ourselves. We blame so much more easily than understand. What we don't always see is that blame does take us a step away from compassion and from wise response. Blame is almost paralyzing. We can be so busy with, it's your fault, it's my fault. We don't see that this busyness of this blame in itself is suffering. It is suffering in itself. I think our capacity to hold, to meet, to embrace suffering without blame is actually the beginning of compassion. Anger without compassion becomes blame. Anger that is sometimes provoked by very real injustice, very real unnecessary suffering. When that anger is combined with compassion, it becomes wise action. And there's a huge difference between those two. A major part of developing compassion is wisdom, is understanding that all things arise because of conditions. You know, last year, one time when I was in America, I was needing to take a taxi from my hotel to the airport. And the hotel had called for a taxi for me to come. And when the taxi driver arrived, I went outside to give him my bag. And just as he took hold of my suitcases, this other taxi cab came racing up, and this other taxi driver jumped out and suddenly started trying to pull my suitcases away from the first taxi driver, saying, they're mine, you know, this is my fare, this is my customer. And within minutes, these two taxi drivers, one was black, one was white. Within minutes, these two taxi drivers were throwing punches at each other, rolling on the ground, swearing at each other, using every kind of racially prejudiced language that you could ever hear equally, you know, between each other. The whole thing was a disaster, you know. I was standing there. My suitcases are in the middle of this kind of riot that's happening on the ground. And I noticed, you know, I found myself, you know, I mean, after a while, they kind of dusted each other off and, you know, it seemed to be over. But it made me think, you know, like, so much hatred, so much prejudice in that moment. And where did it all begin? You know, what did either of those taxi drivers learn at their grandparents' knee? Where did they learn the language of hatred? Where did they learn to feel that in their lives? What were the conditions of hardship, of having to earn a living, that made it so urgent, so desperate to get that one ride to the airport? Sometimes when we look at our own angers, our own fears, our own resistances, we can also begin to wonder, what is the lineage? Where did they even begin? You know, one of the unfortunate qualities, I might say, that I have actually found myself needing to give attention to throughout really my whole life has been the quality of impatience. I mean, I'm much better now, but I used to be a really impatient person. Still sometimes I'm an impatient person. And sometimes when I look at that, you know, I see, well, you know, my father was probably the most impatient person in the whole world. You know, his father was an incredibly impatient person. You know, I start looking at this and I think, where is the beginning? You know, before I was even born, began this lineage of impatience, you know, handed down from generation to generation to generation. I'm doing my best not to hand it down to my children. But, it's, you know, many of these qualities, it's so easy to fix and say, I am like this, as if this has somehow independently arisen out of nowhere. Most of this begins before we were even born. That doesn't mean that we don't take responsibility. But to understand conditions, the conditions of our past experience, of particular views, of the culture that we grew up in, of the fears that we find within our own experience. All of these conditions, they blend together to provide a certain product. Sometimes anger, sometimes fear, sometimes impatience, sometimes feelings of worthlessness. Who really is to blame? Who really is to blame? And does it really help to blame anyone? To really understand that all things arise out of conditions, of course, it's not a justification for some kind of disassociation or irresponsibility, but it is also to understand that we are not helpless. That we are not helpless. That because we have awareness, because we have the possibility of understanding, because we have the capacity for investigation, we have the capacity to nurture compassion and sensitivity, and all of these are part of the fabric, the process of change. Really, everything that we do in meditation is essentially cultivating the conditions that give rise to change. Everything that we do in meditation is cultivating the conditions that give rise to love, to generosity, to balance, to compassion. We are not making ourselves become compassionate, but we are learning to nurture those conditions within the climate of our own heart and mind from which compassion and understanding truly grow. It's not helpful to blame ourselves in those moments when we're not compassionate, because this is just another form of self-hatred. What we can do, and what we learn to do in meditation, is to incline our minds and hearts toward compassion. How? Through intention. Through intention. When we bring into our practice, when we bring into our day, the intention to be awake, the intention to be sensitive, the intention to connect, the intention to listen, what we are doing through those intentions is inclining our hearts and minds towards compassion, to see into the root of suffering. I think it's really helpful to think of compassion not as a noun, but as a verb. Not as a state, but as a verb. This is a very interesting way to see compassion. Not to see it as something that happens as a result of something else. Not to see it as a state that we reach in the future. Not to see it as some kind of fixed place that we arrive at. But to see compassion as a verb. If we think of it as a state, it doesn't work. You know, then we think we're lucky if we run into a moment of compassion, like it's some kind of accident. But to think of the way, what it means to actually incline with intention our hearts and minds towards understanding suffering. And there are countless moments when we meet suffering and pain. Where do we meet it? We certainly meet it in ourselves. We meet it in this fragile body, this fragile life. We meet pain and suffering in the bodies, in the fragile lives of others. The pain that sometimes comes with illness, the suffering that sometimes comes when our bodies break down, the suffering that can come with dying, the suffering that can come with aging. You know, my definition of aging is that those periods of time when everything in your body works well at the same time, they get shorter and shorter. You know, I notice there's always something that's not working these days. Other things work, but they never seem to work at the same time. Recently I went to my dentist, you know, because I've come to that time in my life where my teeth seem to want to liberate themselves from my mouth. And I said to my dentist, you know, when I was there getting yet another cap, I said, you know, what's the problem? What's going on here? He said, it's a design fault called aging. He says, your teeth think your body should be dead. Helpful, huh? I've already outlived my teeth. Sometimes, you notice what happens in yourself when your body starts to break down a little. We can get very depressed. We can get very frustrated. We can feel quite helpless. Sometimes when we meet pain or suffering in our bodies, one of our first responses is, how do I make this go away? You've probably noticed that when you sit. How do I make this go away? How do I get rid of this? How do I fix this? Somebody must have an answer. Now, sometimes we can. That's the amazing thing. Sometimes we can make things go away. We can fix things. And sometimes we can't. And that's very humbling. And in those times when we cannot fix suffering, those are the times when we really are asked to dive so deeply within ourselves, to find the patience and the steadiness and the balance to hold this body as it is. Learning to hold all bodies as they are. Knowing when we layer suffering upon pain. The Buddha once said, if you really want to know about compassion, he said, look into the eyes of a mother as she holds and cradles her sick and fevered child. Sometimes it's easier to find compassion for our bodies than it is for our minds. You know, when we get lost in those storms of confusion, those raging moments of obsession, of judgment, of greed, of jealousy, when we meet other people's minds that are filled with prejudice or intolerance or conflict, it's so easier to find blame than it is to find compassion for our minds. We say sometimes when we meet our own minds or the mind of another, we say, I should know better. You know, I should really know better. I should be different. You should have a different mind. We think we should be able to find some strategy to fix this mind, to improve it, to fix other people's minds. Somehow we have this mythology or this illusion that we're somehow in control of our minds. I mean, did anybody here get up this morning and say, oh, this is a really good day to be obsessive, you know, or this is a really good day to be depressed or judgmental? Probably not. I mean, when you sat down with those kind of raging mind storms, you know, did you offer an invitation? And say, oh yes, you know, that's just what I feel like doing right now, you know, is being caught up in this incredible, you know, trip of the mind. No. When we meet someone else who seems to be raging and filled with their own intolerance, do we really believe that they feel happy and free within that? The conditions are there that lead to suffering, and it is suffering. Our minds do suffer. And we are asked to dive very deeply within ourselves to find the forgiveness and the tolerance and the acceptance and compassion for this mind and for all minds. We might even say, if you want to know what compassion looks like, look into the eyes of a mother as she cradles her angry, raging child. We meet the suffering that comes with change, all the losses and separations and endings that we meet in our lives, the disappointments and frustrations that come when things change in a way that we don't always welcome. We meet the suffering that comes with separation, being separated from ourselves, separated from compassion, being separated from some meditation experience that turns into one that we enjoy much less. This too is painful, and it asks for a boundless warmth, a boundless compassion. We are not always in control. We can't always control our own mind, never mind the mind of another. But not being in control, it doesn't mean that we are out of control, because we can be present. We can learn, we can stay connected, we can turn away from, or we can turn towards suffering that we meet. And all of the suffering of injustice and oppression and pain and violence that we find in our world, this above all else, asks for a profound compassion. This is a Tibetan prayer that says, grant that I may be given appropriate difficulties so that my practice of wisdom can be awakened and my path of compassion truly fulfilled. To think of holding all suffering in a compassionate heart, it's too big a thought. To think of ending all suffering, it's too big a thought. To think about having compassion in every moment, it's too big a thought. But what about just this moment? What about the pain we meet in just one moment that we're present in? The more that we incline our hearts and minds towards compassion, the more it grows. And there are many opportunities for that growing. The person we meet who's in pain, the person who's insensitive, the image of violence on our television, the siren in the distance. We can meet these just one moment at a time to learn to lay down our impatience, our blame, our disconnection, and begin to see that we can listen. In Buddhism, the word for compassion, it's translated as means the heart that quivers in response to suffering. The heart that trembles in response to suffering. We can learn to gently release those feelings of disconnection. And as we release them, there is the space and the room for compassion to begin to flower. One of the very powerful qualities of compassion is empathy. The capacity to place ourselves in the hearts and the minds of another. The capacity to place ourselves in the heart and the mind of the homeless person on the street. The person who is hungry, the person who is afraid, the person who's in prison, the person who's exiled, the person who's a refugee, to place ourselves in their heart and mind and begin to sense what that life really is. What that life truly is. We don't always have an answer for it, and that is something that is so humbling. We don't always have an answer, but we always have the capacity to stay present. We always have the capacity to stay connected. And sometimes that is the most powerful healing presence of all. The Dalai Lama once said, I have found that the greatest degree of inner tranquility comes from the development of love and compassion. The more we care for the happiness of others, the greater is our own sense of well-being. Cultivating a close, warm-hearted feeling for others puts the mind at ease. Whether one believes in religion or not, there isn't anyone who doesn't appreciate kindness and compassion. If we take just a couple of moments quietly together.